Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for tuning in, and welcome back. Today we're going to talk about Einstein and quantum mechanics, continuing our series, A World Without Einstein. So what exactly is quantum mechanics, and what does Einstein have to do with it? And what, in our daily lives, is impacted by these discoveries? Well, quantum mechanics is the field of physics that deals with the very small, the microworld. Generally, we're talking about molecules, atoms, and things that are even smaller than atoms. And as we'll see, nature behaves very differently at the microworld scale than it does at the scale of the universe that we are accustomed to, the macroworld. Human beings have a very evolved sense of the world around them. We are very well adapted to our surroundings, and we all have a very effective mental model of the world. That characteristic has propelled humanity to the top of the food chain. But it doesn't serve us well at all when we're talking about the microworld, because as we said, nature is quite different in the microworld, and our everyday intuition simply doesn't apply. So everyone, physicists included, have pretty much agreed that the theory of quantum mechanics, which is about the microworld, really is weird. Niels Bohr, who was one of the leading developers of quantum mechanics, once said that if quantum mechanics hasn't profoundly shocked you, then you simply haven't understood it yet. And Richard Feynman said, "I think that I can safely say that no one understands quantum mechanics." Now, Bohr and Feynman won their Nobel Prizes in physics for the development of quantum mechanics. So I think what they meant was that although we know all the equations, and although we know how to do the math, and although we know how to make the predictions of quantum mechanics, and we have confirmed them to great precision, nonetheless, no one really understands why nature behaves the way she does at the microworld. As we usually do, we have some great images for you to look at on the website, and since some of the concepts today in quantum mechanics are particularly challenging, I think that you're going to find these images even more helpful than usual. So open a second window, go to guidetothecosmos.com, click on the microphone icon, and that will bring up a menu of radio shows and pick today's show, Einstein and Quantum Mechanics. The theory of quantum mechanics is based on two very important principles. The first is particle-wave duality, which we have discussed earlier and we'll get back to in a few minutes. And the second is quantization. Quantization sounds like a $10 word, but it's really a very simple notion. If you look at image number one on the website, you see the comparison between the microworld on the right and the macroworld on the left. The microworld looks like a staircase, and the macroworld looks like a ramp. So in the macroworld, objects like planets orbiting a sun can have any energy at all. Just like a person could be at any elevation at all on a ramp. You simply need to position yourself at the right place on the ramp and you can have any elevation that you wish. On a staircase, however, things are different. You can have the elevation of the first step or the elevation of the second step, or of the 17th step, but you can never be at the elevation of the 2.5 step, because there is no such thing as the 2.5 step. You're going to either be at the second step or the third step, but you can't be in between. And as it turns out, that's the way nature often behaves in the micro world. Electrons in an atom can have certain energies, but not others. They're restricted to a specific and limited set of energies. Unlike a planet, which again can orbit a star at any distance whatsoever. Now let's talk about how the theory of quantum mechanics was first developed. In the 19th century, physicists developed a wonderful theory called thermodynamics, which was all about heat and how gases behave when you heat them and cool them. And this was a very important theory to have at that time because steam engines were one of the most important technological developments of the age. And if you understood heat and gases, you could design more efficient steam engines. And the theory of thermodynamics was very effective at that, so it was a major accomplishment. But it did have one major problem, and that was called the ultraviolet catastrophe. Now, this wasn't a catastrophe on the scale of world war or anything like that, but physicists were nonetheless very disturbed that their wonderful theory, which worked so well in designing steam engines, had a glaring flaw. The flaw was that thermodynamics said that a hot object, like an oven, would radiate the same total amount of energy at each frequency. So there would be a certain amount of energy coming out at 1 megahertz, and the same amount of energy coming out at 2 megahertz, and the same amount of energy coming at 100 megahertz, and that all seems very democratic and all, but the problem is that there are an infinite number of frequencies. And if each of them has a specific amount of energy that it's emitting, then there will be an infinite amount of energy being emitted in total. There's an infinite range of frequencies, and so there's no limit to how much energy a hot object like an oven was supposed to radiate. Well, this is clearly wrong. It means that if I was to light a match, I would cremate the entire universe because the match would emit an infinite amount of energy. Well, whenever physicists come up with an answer of infinity, they're almost always wrong, and obviously this was one of those examples. In the year 1900, Max Planck, who became one of the most famous physicists of that era, largely due to this discovery, found out that there was a solution to this ultraviolet catastrophe if one assumed that the amount of energy had to come out in certain buckets. It had to be quantized, like steps on a staircase. It could not be continuous like a ramp. So now take a look at the second image on our website. At the bottom is a display which shows the range of frequencies of electromagnetic radiation, or as I would say, the range of frequencies of light. It starts at the very low frequency end, the low energy end, with microwave radiation. Moving to the left, we have infrared, then the very narrow portion of the spectrum that our eyes can detect, which is called visible light. Moving further to the left and further in the direction of increasing energy, we have ultraviolet light, then X-rays, and finally at the top end, gamma rays. Well, as the chart attempts to illustrate, if the amount of energy in each frequency band is the same, and just for simplicity, we'll call that 1, then as the frequency goes up, then the flux being emitted must go down. So let's make the comparison with a waterfall. If water is pouring from the top of the waterfall, falling down to the bottom, it's releasing a certain amount of energy. That amount of energy will increase as the height of the waterfall increases, and it will also increase as the amount of water falling off the lip of the waterfall increases. So we could think of the frequency as representing the height of the waterfall, and X, the flux, representing the amount of water coming over the edge. And what the theory of thermodynamics claimed was that the total energy would be a constant regardless of the height of the waterfall, or in this case, the frequency. So as the frequency increases, the flux decreases. And as we see on the chart, it decreases in a way such that the product, frequency times flux, which is labeled X, is a constant. So it's always equal to 1. At 1 pentahertz, we have 1 unit of flux. At 10 pentahertz, we have a tenth of a unit of flux, and so on. So what Planck suggested was that the flux could not be any old value at all, like any position on a ramp, but rather it had to be integral numbers of steps, like a staircase. And so you could have a flux of 10, or a flux of 1,700, or a flux of 3, or a flux of 1, but you couldn't have a flux of 1/10 or less. Anything less than 1 would be excluded because that's less than the first step. So the problem that thermodynamics had, this ultraviolet catastrophe, was that the amount of energy was always the same at all frequencies and added up in total to infinity. Now, Planck's suggestion solved the problem because whenever the flux became less than 1, it got truncated down to 0. And so there was a cutoff. In any given situation, it might be at a different frequency, but there would always be a cutoff at the high frequency end, at the ultraviolet end, and by dropping the flux to 0, the energy emitted became 0, and so we no longer had a sum that added up to infinity. Well, this was a cute little mathematical trick, and Planck was duly proud of it, but he thought it was nothing more than a mathematical trick. But our friend Einstein saw beyond that. He believed that if the math worked, that there must be an underlying physical reason for that math to be the way it is. That nature had to have a characteristic that we hadn't previously understood, which was reflected in the fact that the math worked. And Einstein had a great idea as to what that underlying physical reason was. It fit in very well with his solution to the photoelectric effect, namely that light is not a continuous beam of energy, but rather that light is made of individual particles, which we call photons. And clearly, Einstein said, you never have half a photon or half a particle of anything else. And so, when the flux that was called for in our chart dropped to be less than 1, then of course it had to be 0, because you couldn't emit less than 1 particle. Einstein said that the quantization of light exactly explained the reason why Planck's math worked. So one might think that Max Planck would be the second happiest physicist in the world now that someone had explained why his trick really made sense. But indeed, he rejected Einstein's idea. As much as Planck supported Einstein, and it was Planck who published Einstein's papers in his miracle year of 1905, and it was Planck that got Einstein a job, and it was Planck that pushed hard for Einstein to get the Nobel Prize. As much as Planck endorsed and supported Einstein at every turn in his life, and even though Einstein had proposed a rationale that fit in perfectly with Max Planck's mathematical trick, Max Planck never indeed accepted Einstein's suggestion that the answer was that light was made of individual particles called photons, and that they were real. More than just a mathematical trick, photons were real. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we're talking today about Einstein and quantum mechanics. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back. You're listening to Guide to the Cosmos, and I am your host, Robert Piccioni. Today we're talking about Einstein and quantum mechanics. Let's shift now to talk about Einstein's other contributions to quantum mechanics. These include the so-called Bose-Einstein statistics, which is the basis for Einstein's developing a theory of lasers, which we've talked about in a different radio show, and Einstein's proposal that light was a particle as well as a wave, which developed into the concept called particle-wave duality, that indeed everything is both a particle and a wave. Now, this suggestion leads us immediately to one of the most startling things about quantum mechanics, and that is that it says that nature is fundamentally uncertain. And it is this uncertainty of quantum mechanics that Einstein was never able to accept. And so it is as if Einstein had opened Pandora's box and let out the genie of uncertainty with his own suggestion of particle wave duality. And it was a genie that Einstein rejected for the rest of his life, and did so in complete futility. The rest of the physics world embraced the uncertainty of quantum mechanics as a true description of nature, leaving Einstein and very few of his followers to protest. In the end, science must be led by the observations of what nature actually does. Our theories could be great, could be elegant, could be wonderful, could be pleasing, but they're not worth anything if they don't correspond to the actions of nature. And hardly anything that mankind knows works better in reflecting the true properties of nature than does the theory of quantum mechanics. It has been tested hundreds of thousands of times, and none of its predictions have ever been falsified. Indeed, one of its most spectacular and surprising predictions has been confirmed to 12 decimal digits. That's one part in a trillion. I would allege there's almost nothing that mankind knows about our universe, about our physical world, that we know with such precision. Now, let's see how this particle-wave duality leads us to the uncertainty that's predicted by quantum mechanics and confirmed by experiment. The French prince and physicist Louis de Broglie generalized on Einstein's notion that light was both a particle and a wave, and said that, to be fair, particles should be waves, just as waves had become particles. And he predicted that every particle would have a wavelength, which is determined by a formula based on its momentum. The higher the momentum, in other words, the faster it's moving, the higher its energy, the shorter would be its wavelength. Now, this seemingly weird idea had an immediately wonderful consequence, and that was it explained why atoms were stable. Now, none of us really question why atoms are stable. We know that they must be, otherwise we would immediately fall apart. But understanding why exactly they were stable was a challenge that classical physics was unable to meet. You see that the equations of electrodynamics worked out by Faraday and Maxwell in the 19th century demand that a charged particle which is accelerated emit radiation. So an electron circling around the nucleus of an atom must be accelerated. That's what makes it circle. And so, according to this theory, it must emit radiation. Well, if it emits radiation, then it's going to lose energy. It's going to spiral in toward the nucleus. It's going to be more accelerated there and emit more energy and spiral in even further. And it should very quickly, in fact, spiral all the way into the nucleus, collapsing the atom entirely. In fact, this process should take less than about a hundredth of a millionth of a second. So the question is, why doesn't this happen in accordance with the predictions of Maxwell's equations? Well, Niels Bohr was the physicist who understood this and proposed a solution. Bohr's solution is illustrated in image number 4 on the website. On the left, we see a yellow nucleus, the central dot, surrounded by a green band, which indicates the orbit of the electron around the nucleus. At the 12 o'clock position, we have labeled that A. If we were to imagine cutting that band at A and stretching it out linearly so that we can better visualize it, then we would have a horizontal band representing the electron's orbit. It would start at A on the left, corresponding to the 12 o'clock position on the circular orbit, and it would run across to A on the right, again corresponding to the same 12 o'clock position, because that's where we cut the orbit. So now, if the electron had a wavelength, then as it moves from A on the left to A on the right, it's going to be waving up and down. And Bohr said that because A is really the same place at the left and the right, the wave action of the electron must match at the two ends. This is like saying that the map of the Earth laid out flat might have the international date line on the left and the international date line on the right, but actually the left and the right are the same position because the international date line is one meridian on the surface of the Earth. It's the same place. So Bohr said it's not possible to have a wavelength which is high on the left side and low on the right side because the left and the right sides are connected. The wavelength has to be the same at both ends. And this can only happen if the number of waves is an integer as the electron moves throughout its orbit. So there have to be an integer number of wavelengths across the electron's orbit. So the equation for that is shown here. It's that the circumference of the orbit, 2 pi r, has to be an integer n times the wavelength of the electron. So now moving to image number 5 on the website, we see that electrons stack up in orbits around the nucleus in these specific places which correspond to the circumference being an integer number of wavelengths. So there is an innermost orbit with one wavelength all the way around. That's surrounded by a more distant orbit with two wavelengths going around, and an even more distant orbit with three wavelengths going around, and so forth. And each of those orbits has a specific energy because it corresponds to a specific average distance of the electron from the nucleus. And that's illustrated on the right side of image number 5, where we see three specific energies indicated for the three specific orbits that the electron can have. So the electron can't have just any old energy, it has to have one of those specific values. So it can't spiral all the way into the nucleus because that's not an allowed orbit. It's like saying that the electron has to be on one of the steps on a staircase, and the lowest step that it can be on is this innermost one wavelength orbit. So it can't get any closer to the nucleus than that, and that's why atoms don't immediately collapse. Obviously, it's a very good thing for all of us. Now, as a consequence of that, let's look at image number 6 on the website. Here we see that because each type of atom has a specific set of energy levels, it also has a specific set of frequencies of light that it can emit and absorb. And that's because if the electron makes a transition from one energy level to another, let's say that it drops from the second energy level down to the first, then it will lose a certain amount of energy. And because energy is conserved, that energy the electron loses has to be converted into a photon of light that the atom radiates away. And that photon has to have exactly the right amount of energy to correspond to the specific energy levels that the electron has in that type of atom. Conversely, if a photon with exactly that energy came in and hit the atom, it could lift the electron from the first energy level up to the second. But if it had a different energy, then it couldn't lift the electron at all. So atoms emit and absorb only light with specific frequencies that correspond to the differences in the various specific energy levels that they have. And so we get these so-called spectra, illustrated in the bottom of image number 6. We have the spectra of three different types of atoms there: hydrogen on top, mercury in the middle, and neon at the bottom. And each of the lines that you see and the different colors in these spectra indicate frequencies of light that that type of atom either emits or absorbs. And indeed, you see that the frequency spectrum of each of these atoms is completely different. Each is a unique fingerprint that determines what kind of atom it is simply by looking at what kind of light that atom emits or absorbs. So, as an interesting side story, in the year 1842, the French philosopher Auguste Comte said that there were things that mankind will never know. And as a principal example, he gave the chemical composition of the stars. Now, it seemed at the time that Auguste was on firm ground, because first of all, how would you get to a star? And if you did, what would you do to chemically analyze it? I mean, would you reach down with a spoon and pick up some star stuff and take it back to your lab? I mean, you'd be instantly cremated along with your spoon and your spaceship. So it seemed Auguste was safe in saying we would never know the chemical composition of the stars. But as luck would have it, within a few decades, scientists did just that. By analyzing the light that comes from stars and using the unique fingerprints of each element that we can determine in our own laboratories, we now are able to determine exactly what the chemical composition is of every star and galaxy in the heavens. So Auguste would have been better off if he had picked a different example. Perhaps, indeed, he is correct that there are things that man will never know, such as what his wife is really thinking, but at least about stars, he was wrong. Okay, so now let's talk about particles and waves and see how that gets us to the uncertainty principle. If you look at a wave, For instance, on image number 7 on the website, on the left-hand side, we have 5 waves of different frequencies. Each of those waves extends all the way to infinity on both sides. So each of those waves has a definite frequency, but a completely indefinite location. It spreads everywhere, so we have no way of localizing it, but we do know precisely what its frequency is. Equivalently, we know precisely what its wavelength is. Well, that doesn't seem like a particle, because usually we know where particles are. So the trick is that we can take a sequence of waves and sum them all up together and produce what is called a wave packet, as shown in the center right of that image number 7. So here you see that the wave packet is relatively localized. Not completely localized, it's still a little broad, but at least it's not completely spread out like the waves on the left. Now the trade-off has become that we no longer know exactly what the wavelength of the wave packet is, because indeed it's a composition of waves of different wavelengths. And so there is a trade-off here that we inevitably have to face. The more we want the wave packet to be localized in a smaller and smaller area, the larger the number of wavelengths that we need to combine, which increases our uncertainty as to the wave packet's wavelength. And if we want to know the wavelength very precisely, then we have to give up the localization in space. The wave packet will become very broad if we restrict the number of wavelengths. There is an inevitable trade-off, and we are stuck with the equation on the bottom of the slide that the uncertainty in the position of the wave packet multiplied by the uncertainty in the wavelength of the wave packet will always have to be greater than some number. The two uncertainties can't both be very, very small, because then their product would be less than this specific number. We can drive one of those uncertainties down as low as we like, but only at the price of driving the other one up by a corresponding amount so that their product remains greater than the specific number. And this equation is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Heisenberg said that there are inherent and fundamental uncertainties in nature. The uncertainty in knowing the position of a particle multiplied by the uncertainty in knowing its momentum, which corresponds to its wavelength, will always have to be greater than some number. And similarly, the uncertainty that we have in knowing the energy of a particle multiplied by the uncertainty that we have in knowing when it had that energy is also constrained to be a product that's bigger than this certain number. And this number turns out to be Planck's constant divided by 2 pi. Now, Einstein hated all of this. He hated the notion that physics had determined that nature was uncertain because it violated his sense of propriety and elegance that he believed the universe would obey. And he fought this with all of his might for the remainder of his life, and he lost every one of the battles. He proposed many ingenious devices that he claimed would prove quantum mechanics wrong, and in each case, it was shown that it was Einstein himself that was in error. One of these devices was the so-called Einstein clock box. In this box was a clock mechanism that operated a shutter, and the shutter would be opened by this mechanism for an extremely brief period of time. There was also a photon bouncing around inside the box, and Einstein's notion was that when the shutter opened, the photon would be allowed to escape, and that would reduce the mass of the box, because the energy of the photon would leave the box, reducing its effective mass. Remember Einstein's equation, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, E equals mc squared. So Einstein said we could weigh the box before the shutter opened and weigh the box after the shutter opened and detect the change in mass and compute, therefore, the exact energy of the photon, and we could compare that with the exact knowledge of when the shutter opened and closed, and Einstein claimed that we could make each of those uncertainties as small as we wished, and so their product could be as small as we wished, and even less than what Heisenberg specified. Well, when Einstein proposed this clock box to Niels Bohr at the Solvay conference, Niels Bohr got a migraine and wasn't able to sleep all night. But when he came back in the morning with a smile on his face, he told Einstein, "You're wrong. You forgot your own theory of general relativity." And as Bohr explained, that when the photon leaves and changes the position of the box in the gravitational field, that affects the rate at which the clock will count time. So Einstein's suggestion was foiled by his own theory of relativity. We'll continue this discussion in our next episode of World Without Einstein. So thank you for tuning in. And remember, you are never too old or too young to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.